Hello and welcome to Physics Frontiers episode number 55, Multiversality. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/55. Show notes include the papers we read for this podcast, books we may have mentioned, and other relevant items that I can think of. And now, Jim and Randy. Hey Randy, how's it going?
Jim, you never tire of your chipper hello. It's good to hear from you. We're going to have some fun today. We're going to talk about one of the most popular mainstays of science fiction stories in the media today, this idea of multiversality.
Multiversality, and this is because we're talking about this Wilczek paper from Classical and Quantum Gravity of the same name. Are we talking about science fiction because the second reference in this paper is to Dragon's Egg by Robert Forward?
I did not know that was a reference. No, I mean, you just look everywhere. You look at any Star Trek or Stargate SG-1 or the movies. I mean, everybody loves talking about and playing with the plot lines available when you have alternative universes or like alternate realities and people can jump between them and all that kind of stuff. But I thought we should talk about this because it seems like it's such a popular idea because it makes such great stories that everybody assumes that it's true.
Well, Frank Wilczek thinks it's true.
He seems to lean in that direction. Yes, he does seem to be pro-multiverse, but let's look at all the arguments. We also read the Why the Universe is Just So by Craig Hogan.
And the reference to that is, of course, to Kipling, right, who had his Just So stories. And those were stories that sort of explained why something ended up the way it did. And it had to have a very particular sort of way of doing things. Now, how the leopard got his spots is one of those stories that sort of references that. But it's a real biology book that's trying to explain evolution. That's a problem they have with evolution a lot of times, is that people find a rationale why something is based on evolution, even though there's no real evidence for it. They just say, well, it happened, so there has to have been an evolutionary reason for it to have happened. And then they build up a long series of arguments for why that is the way it is. And in this case, what we're talking about in both the Hogan paper and in the multiversality paper is the anthropic principle. And the anthropic principle has basically two parts, right? And one part is the anthropic principle itself, which says that we have to live in a universe where we can live. Therefore, the laws of physics have to be viable for people like us to exist on a planet like this, orbiting around a star like that, and so forth and so on. And Steven Weinberg is fairly famous for having shown that this is a useful way to figure out what is happening in astronomy sometimes, or perhaps astrophysics. Now it's sort of been elevated, because of Weinberg's success, it's been elevated to something that people want to look at. And we can talk about some of the pitfalls of that later.
But that was a dark energy prediction, right? Like he used the anthropic principle to put constraints on the density of dark energy. And then they measured it and they found it to be pretty much within his parameters, right?
I think so. And I think that was the idea that the dark energy would have to be the largest it could be for us to actually exist. So it's a little bit more complicated than that, but it's not that much more complicated than that. So that is a kind of weird argument, but I don't really know it that well, and I don't seem to have outlined it here.
That might be an interesting show to do, actually, because I'm sure it's an interesting argument to follow.
Probably is. It probably is, and I think the reference is in here, unless this is another. Both of these guys reference Weinberg, so those are probably good references in here. I'm not sure if they're the first time he used it, the most famous time. So the first thing is you have that anthropic principle, and in some ways that's reasonable, right? Obviously, we do exist, so the world has to be like we exist. So if your theory says that we couldn't exist, there's something wrong with it. And sometimes you can make some positive predictions because of that, because we're so unlikely, right, that something has to go on. That's going to be a problem later on. On top of that, they're going to talk about something called selection effects. I don't recall. It's been a while since I read the Hogan paper. Was he talking a lot about selection in that one as well?
Yeah, I mean, he described pretty much the same argument that Wilczek described in his paper on multiversality, where he talked about how, you know, there's like 19 free parameters in the standard model, or the minimum standard model. I guess that's without supersymmetry. But there's only something like 5 of those which need to be pretty much fine-tuned in order for the kind of organized structures and life processes and everything to have been possible. And so they identify the same ones, you know, like the mass of the up and down quark, you know, the fine structure constant, I think. There are a couple others. But yeah, they talk about the same ones. They look at, you know, what the universe would be like if we had significant different values for those particular ones. So there was really only a handful where it needed to be really close to what they are now.
And the selection effect is going to be saying that all sorts of things are possible, but because we're here, we're in a universe that has these particular constants, these particular ratios between masses of different quarks, that these particular ratios, like the fine structure constant and the other similar constants for the weak force and the strong force and things like that.
Oh, and I should mention the other thing was that these are selection oriented in the sense that this various symmetry arguments don't constrain them to be what they are. Like with a lot of those other free parameters, they think that certain symmetry arguments can sort of force them to be what they are. With these ones, there's no obvious physical argument to say that the mass of the up quark and down quark should be this or that, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you've ever looked at the masses of those things, they don't make any sense, right? I mean, they just look completely random. That's not really what you'd expect, especially in something that's supposed to be so symmetric, right? You've got the different flavors of these different quarks, and they come in these generations, and you'd expect somehow that these generations would be related to each other, right?
Yeah, you'd expect it would be a nice architecture for why their masses are sort of, or at least grouped in a certain way, right?
Yeah, you know, you have the up and the down quark, and they have a ratio of masses, and then you have the strange and the charm, and then you have the bottom and the top. You'd expect that however those are changing, it would make sense how they were changing, right? At least if you thought that there was some underlying reason why they had some particular value. But if you look at it, if you try to do the numerology, they're just in sort of random places. It's not like you just say, okay, the first generation has that ratio of masses, then you double it for the second generation, then you double it again for the third generation or something like that. There's nothing going on like that. It's just a bunch of random numbers that happen to be increasing. So whatever's going on, it's at least not something that's perfectly clear comes from the symmetry. There could be something else that we don't know about, and maybe that'll do it. But at least from the stuff we look at, they just look like completely random sort of numbers.
So that's where the selection effects come in. They're like, so the argument is, since they seem to be so arbitrary, then the laws of physics must be such that they could take on any range of values. And since we see the values that we see, we must be in one specific, you know, subcategory of universe among a whole spectrum where there's values for those things which are very different.
Yeah, so what we've already gotten into is, I guess, the second kind of multiversality. And that is the situation where the standard model gives us a really strong idea about how these forces work together, how the forces and the particles work together. But it doesn't really tell us the things we'd love to know, like the fine structure constant, right? This is one of the big, amazing things from QED, right? QED says this is what's going to happen, and it does. But there are a lot of things that just don't work that well. We don't get these really small errors.
Yeah, I think there was another example they cited. I think it was the anomalous magnetic moment of the electron, which they'd measured to like 4 parts in a billion or something.
Well, yeah, that's the one that's really good. That was the prediction from QED. That's what makes QED one of the best tested theories that exists out there. I'm looking at Wilczek's other paper because he has some nice tables, but he doesn't do any comparisons. He just has the measured values and doesn't say which ones are predicted and how far they are off. But yeah, so that particular moment for the electron is really well known, and it's a really good fit to the theory. But then when you go to the muon and you go to the Tau, or possibly the Tauon, some people apparently call it the Tauon, it's all over the place. For the G minus 2 value for the muon, there's a big error. That's a problem that people have with this whole standard model thing. And for the Tau lepton, the G minus 2 value is all over the place. It could be negative, it could be positive, they don't know. They don't know if it's larger than 2 or less than 2. It's just got a huge error.
That's interesting. It's funny that it gets it so correct on the electron, and yet the related particles, the heavier versions of those particles are so far off. It really makes you wonder. That's kind of the overall nature of these arguments, right? Like, I think it's important to point out that we have absolutely no empirical evidence whatsoever to think that there's a multiverse. Right, that like the entire argument is based on this kind of circumstantial reasoning based on the anthropic principle. And there are some good arguments there, because there are things that we don't know, but there's things that we think that we should be able to see a symmetry in if there was one. I kind of have a problem with that, even that line of reasoning, because we don't have a grand unified theory yet, and we may find there's a good reason for like the gravitational constant to be exactly what it is.
That's a reasonable, I think that's a reasonable critique of this, right, is that, you know, there's no positive reason to believe that, or at least it doesn't look like there's a positive reason to believe that. And even Wilczek, I think I want to go through a couple of his things in a second, but even Wilczek has a warning here, right?
Yes, I like that. You don't want to stop doing fundamental physics.
That's right.
You just throw everything off to the anthropic principle, because of the whole point of this enterprise is to find answers.
Possibly. You can use the selection effects. You can say, okay, if there were 10 billion universes out there, it'd be much more than that, we just happen to be in this particular one, maybe you could find some reason why different parameters have different values based on that reasoning. But obviously there could be a real reason, not just this anthropic reason. But Wilczek does think that there are several reasons for there to be a universe. There has to be a universe, right?
You mean a multiverse.
A multiverse, excuse me, yes. And his question is, in several places, are there aspects of observable reality, of the things that we see, that can be explained by the existence of a multiverse, but can't be explained without it? And he actually says yes to that in three places.
I have problems with all of them.
Yeah. And although the first one has nothing to do with the other two, the other two are the sort of multiversality we've just been talking about. The first one has to do with sort of the Everett interpretation, the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. What he says here is that the apparent indeterminism of quantum mechanics, despite its deterministic equations, can only be explained by multiverses. And I don't think that's true. I don't think you do either from what you just said.
That's right.
I have some reasons for that. What are the reasons you had?
Well, I have a problem with the many worlds interpretation just in principle, because there's a very vibrant and, I think, compelling debate that it doesn't actually explain the Born rule, the probability function. If all possible outcomes of every quantum event is personified as like a coexisting solution to the universal wave function, then it still doesn't give you the nice bell curve probability distributions for the results of your experiment. Like, it doesn't give you that. So it doesn't actually answer what it was created to answer, the whole probabilistic nature of the outcome of an experiment, or a measurement, I should say.
I think we've talked about this before, and we've mentioned that if you read Hawking's Emergence of Probability, that was actually an interpretation of probability itself, that every time you threw some dice, you know, sometimes it'd come out 7s, sometimes it'd come out 11s, sometimes it would come out snake eyes, whatever. Another universe split off from this one. That was an early interpretation of probability itself. And that people didn't go for. I shouldn't say that. People went for it, but eventually it sort of died out. This one apparently is getting a little bit more traction, at least these days. You know, the way we're talking about that, we just listened to that, what it says. It doesn't go along with any of the other stuff here. But It does say that there would be extra multiverses. The problem I have with this is, you know, Wilczek says that can be explained, the existence of multiverses, by multiversality, but not otherwise. And we do have other explanations for it. Now, you don't like the de Broglie-Bohm model any longer. But it still works, right? And it still explains the same thing, only differently. That actually says that that's not the only way to do it. Like I said, Bell felt that de Broglie and Bohm didn't really like their model. It was an existence proof, and it still seems to have some traction. So that was the first one. I don't think it holds up at all, right?
Yeah, it's a big thing to say that there is no other explanation for something, right? I mean, that's a pretty presumptuous position. I mean, like you pointed out, there certainly is an alternative way of explaining this, but there could also be many more. And we could one day arrive at the correct understanding of that, which snaps it all into focus. So I think that it's a big statement just to try to say a negative like that. Like there is no other explanation for something.
It is a pretty strong claim. Yeah, it is a little bit hard to see why he decided that was something he could claim like that. The second one was dark energy, and we've talked about this several times. He said that the outrageously small non-zero value of dark energy can only be explained by multiversality, but not otherwise. I'm not sure how good that explanation is, but at least in this case, there don't seem to be any really good alternative explanations either. I just don't think this is a really good explanation. It doesn't tell me what the dark energy is.
We've looked at multiple models.
I don't know that this is a great way to explain dark energy, is saying, well, there's always going to be dark energy in the universe, just sometimes it's bigger and sometimes it's smaller. Was interesting in here, it actually explained where the different values for the dark energy come from. And there were three of them, right? So we've said that the dark energy, sometimes people say it's 10 to the 60 times too small. Sometimes they say it's 10 to the 120 times too small. Those are actually from different ways to estimate what it would be. And here somewhere he says what it is. So,
oh, he said the 10 to the 60th was based on the energy scale from the electroweak scale and perhaps associated with a low energy supersymmetry. And then the second, he said the 10 to the 120th was from the breaking of unified gauge symmetry. And the third, which was infinite, was from the divergent zero point energy of quantum field theories.
That's a thing from quantum field theory. I think the whole point of quantum field theory is to renormalize that away, right?
That's right.
So yeah. I don't really buy that last one. But the other two, I mean, they're two different rationales people have had for why there's a dark energy. They've both been way off. And obviously infinite is not a good rationale for it at all. But I don't think this is any better an explanation. This is saying it is what it is, right?
Yeah, I guess he's trying to say that there must be universes that have every possible dark energy density and that we just happen to be the one that fits.
And I guess the third thing here is the opaque and scattered values of the standard model parameters that are not subject to selection. So we were talking about things that are subject to selection previously. But, you know, these mixing angles for both the quarks and now, this is a little bit later than these papers, we have the oscillations in the neutrino masses, right? That also requires a mixing angle. Those things apparently don't have any real effect on whether or not human beings could exist or not. They just happen to be out there. There's no good reason why they oscillate with this probability or some other probability. Nobody has any idea why they would oscillate this way, not that way. So, I mean, we're kind of stuck with that one. So I guess the quarks oscillate, the neutrinos oscillate. I don't know if they have any good reason why the leptons do not oscillate. But there's no mixing angle for the electron and the muon, right? So we don't have to worry that our electrons will turn into muons for no particular reason. So at least at this point, there are no other reasons for that, other than it just happened to be that way.
Well, there's no reason that we know. You know, I have to assume, somebody that loves theoretical physics, there has to be an underlying reason for these things happening, right?
Well, it could be, but, you know, the third thing that we didn't talk about yet is Frank Wilczek loves axions.
Yes, which, how can you call on an argument based on a particle which has never been shown to exist?
Possibly because you proposed it.
Right. And if my axiom exists, then this multiverse absolutely does exist. It's like, well, let's prove the first one first.
And unlike most really weird particles, apparently, this one has some traction because even though it's got this really long, crazy chain of, I shouldn't say crazy, of reasoning to explain why it can exist, apparently it sort of could exist. But, I mean, there is a good reason in there for this other claim, right? So you remember that claim is that, you know, for the axions, when the universe cools down enough, all of a sudden there's this sort of Mexican hat potential from this PQ symmetry that apparently explains something about the strong CP problem in quantum chromodynamics. And I forget the names of those guys, Pecci and what? Quinn? And they had this idea that you could invoke this additional symmetry to explain the strong CP problem in quantum chromodynamics. And as you cool down, your nice parabolic potential, or probably paraboloid potential, and it turns into a Mexican hat potential, which means it just has a bump in the center, right? So you have your bowl, and then you have a bump in the center, and then at the bottom is this ring, and anywhere along that ring is a value that describes a particle. And basically that's the axion, is the particle that shows up in the cooling. But it could have any of those values. And so that's a reason why you could have something like a selection effect. There's no real reason why it chose one of those values, but as it cools down, at least for that first part, it has to choose one value. If you have a little mound like that in the bowl, you put a ball at the top of that mound, it will fall down to the bottom and it will have to stop somewhere. It's like a roulette ball, right? It has to stop somewhere, and it's random where it stopped. And at least for this part of the symmetry, it gets frozen there until it gets to an even lower energy, and then something else happens, and it's supposed to fall down to zero. At least that's a rationale that explains how the selection effects work. If you start with inflation, if you start with something that's a really big ball of energy, and then it cools down, then it's possible that for some of these particular parameters, when it cooled down, they just chose a value.
That doesn't sound very physical. He's saying that these axions would be present in the current universe in the form of dark matter, right?
He's saying that the axions, if they have a particular value, are viable dark matter candidates, if they have a particular value for their coupling constant. I don't actually understand, after reading all of this, why this shows up in the multiversality paper, other than the axion could have had all sorts of different values. And we needed to have a particular value if it's going to explain dark matter. He talked about it for 15 pages anyway, right? But, you know, in the end, it's a pretty reasonable explanation for why you could have a random value of a parameter. But thinking about it, after talking about it, it's a good reason why you could have something with a random value. It's not a good reason for the selection. It's a good reason why you have a random value. So I was misstating something. So that makes a little bit of sense, but it's not really satisfying. Possibly that's the only way it's going to be. Possibly that's the only way you're going to get those mixing angles, is by saying, well, they had to be something, right?
Yeah.
And so actually that's probably the strongest view here, but it doesn't actually tell you that you have a multiverse. It just tells you that it had to be something.
And there seems to be some unclarity. I mean, maybe it's me, but are we talking about a multiverse in the sense of, you know, well, we have an observable universe? Then there's, you know, a vast frontier beyond the observable. We know that's there because they've measured the curvature of the universe as closely as they can, and they can see that the curvature doesn't confine us to just the observable universe, that it seems like it's flat to within experimental or observational determination. So it's much bigger than the observable universe. And so there could be, the universe could be so enormous that we don't even see any changes in any of these fundamental constants within our observable sphere, but beyond that, that there could be different values and there could be different physics going on out there. Or in an earlier point in the same paper, he talks about how you can have decoherent states in quantum mechanics, right? Where you can have particles occupying the same space and time that don't influence each other in any sense. So you could possibly have some kind of like layered multiple universes on top of each other. But on the other hand, in the same, like, almost like two paragraphs later, I think he talks about how the space-time curvature of gravity is determined by every contribution of energy and momentum and stress within that area. And so how could these multiverses exist on top of each other without having a huge gravitational signature?
Okay. Oh, that's a lot of things.
Sorry.
Okay. Let's start with the decoherent argument. So the argument is really part of his explanation, which is a better explanation of the Everett interpretation of quantum mechanics, the many worlds interpretation. So that's just saying that every time you have a decision or an observation, not a decision anymore, the world breaks in two. That breaking in two could very easily just mean that it already had all that stuff beforehand. You don't really get into too many problems with that, I don't think. I mean, I always have a problem because it feels like you're adding energy every time you do that. So it always feels a little off to me. And if you are adding energy every time you do that, you're absolutely right. Something's completely wrong. The entire universe would collapse into some weird relativistic object. There probably wouldn't be anything we've thought about. That particular problem, I don't think, has anything to do with this other multiversality, right? Because it all has to do with the wave function of the universe in a particular spot. Each one of those multiverses from Everett should probably have the same constants, except perhaps for ones that were generated at the very beginning during inflation.
Yeah, that's the way I've always read the many worlds interpretation. It wasn't that the fundamental constants in the laws of physics changed from, you know, one iteration to another, but rather that just the outcome of every quantum event would have a representation.
And when he was talking about it, he was talking about the Everett interpretation. He hadn't started talking about changing the parameters. But it could be that each one of these different selection events could have happened during inflation, and then you ended up with a bunch of different decoherent universes that have all the possible values of all the different parameters that could possibly be. I don't buy either of those.
I hate to say it, but I don't either. I'm not going to make any friends with that statement.
Again, I think that's completely divorced from, or at least 95% divorced from, the other multiversality argument. And in that one, you're talking about, you've got our observable universe, and then there's a larger universe, which we call our universe, which is all of the universe that has evolved from the observable universe. That includes stuff that's more or less contemporaneous with us, because technically everything that's outside of that light cone is contemporaneous with us. But really, you know, we can think of, you know, a whole bunch of evolution happening after that, and everything in the future past that. And all that should have the same sort of values that we have, probably. It's possible that we have too small a purview to see oscillations and variations. And people have said that they think there could be oscillations and variations in, you know, G, for example. That's one of their favorites, is saying the gravitational constant could be changing in different places. But probably not. You have another thing is that, you know, if the universe started from fluctuations to begin with, it could, in an infinite universe, you could have more nucleation events for different universes. I don't know how much sense that really makes, because before there's space-time, what does it mean to be in a different part of space-time, right? And a different part of the universe. Although I guess that would be a different part of the multiverse. But that could happen. You could also have, if you have a big bounce situation, if you have a big bang and big crunch situation, each one of those resets could end up with different values for each one of the different universes that comes out of that. And that would still count as a multiverse for this, and that would still count as being that kind of multiverse.
Yeah, I don't have a big problem with that, except there was this crazy idea. I guess I shouldn't call it a crazy idea, but Frank Tipler came up with a theory. What do you call it? The Omega Theory or something? Where, well, I think what he was trying to do was create like a scientific rationale for Christian belief systems. I think it was rooted in a religious impulse, it seemed to be anyway. But fundamentally, there's an interesting argument there, because what he was ultimately saying was that maybe the universe is the way that it is, not just because the initial conditions determined what it was going to be. Because we normally think of the universe as being born at a certain, you know, space-time coordinate, and then the space-time explodes, and it just rolls forward and does whatever it's going to do. But it's more like the idea that we encountered with Haranov's book, Quantum Paradoxes, where maybe the initial boundary conditions and the final boundary conditions are essential to the birth of the universe in the first place. So maybe the whole evolution of it, it happens all kind of, I guess you could say, at once in a certain sense. Like all of time, all of space, the whole evolution of it, it needs to exist in a certain way. Maybe the laws are and the constants are what they are because the universe couldn't have inflated in the first place unless it was going to end up in a certain state that it needed to end up in, right?
I think that's actually referenced in this paper as well.
Oh, is it?
Barrow and Tipler, the anthropic cosmological principle.
Yeah, but I remember that quote, it seemed like it went back before, long before Tipler had written that paper. So I thought he was referencing a different argument. But maybe, yeah, maybe his thinking's been evolving along those lines for a long time.
I mean, that book came out in 1986. So anyways, those are the things that Wilczek was saying about the multiverse. And I don't think they really fix out very well. You don't think they fix out very well. I mean, apparently this has been something that's been on the rise, right? He gave five reasons why they should be on the rise, but I don't think we should go through them because we're running out of time. I've got a whole list here. The sociology of the multiverse. But people think more and more that these is good. I think it's related to that whole landscape of string theory thing that we had before.
Yes, that did come up in both of these papers, string theory, right?
Yeah, and, you know, string theory is a mainstream theory. It probably should come up if you're talking about something like this.
Because string theory would predict at least 10 to the 500 different types of possible universes, right? And so the argument with string theory is that, well, there's no particular reason why we live in this certain universe. It's just that they all happen and that we're, you know, the anthropic principle, boom, you know.
And I think that's another big thing is that a lot of people who are doing this kind of work are string theorists. And when you went from having three possible string theories to 10 to the 500th or possibly a continuum, and I think that's what we said in the podcast, is that there's a continuum in the middle of the string theory landscape of possible string theories. When you get into that whole situation, you're doing the same thing that you're doing here, which is you're just saying, well, which string theories could work for us? They're all true, but which ones actually work for us, and this is one we're in. Of course, in that case, we were in a metastable state, and hopefully this metastable state won't collapse before we can talk about it again. That's another story. Although it looks like the metastable state is collapsing at the moment.
Why is the metastable state collapsing?
Oh, it's 2020, that's why.
Oh, right, because we're in the middle of the apocalypse. I almost forgot. No, it's kind of scary. I think that's the idea that the vacuum itself is in just kind of a metastable, quasi-stable state, and that it, at any given moment, anywhere in the universe, it could drop to a lower energy state and then radiate out at the speed of light, so you wouldn't even see it coming. You just suddenly stop existing.
Well, that's the way to go.
Yeah, I guess as far as ways to check out, that's a pretty good way to go.
So, yeah, I guess that's the multiverse. We could talk about science fiction and stuff like that. Yes, there are good multiverse stories, but not all of them are. The idea about how the multiverse would kind of work in the continuum setting, I mean, it's just fascinating the way it works in that old Roger Zelazny novel, or set of novels. He at least gets that right. Although it does read like it was written in 1970 on acid, probably because it was written in 1970 and probably because Zelazny was on acid. And that also explains, as I probably explained, Tommy by the Who.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, apparently Pete Townsend got the idea to write Tommy the first time he took acid, and he dropped acid on his way back from the Monterey Festival, going from Monterey back to England. So he got on the plane and he dropped the acid, and I don't know if that was a really good idea.
Okay, so yeah, as far as science goes, you know, it looks like you can make some arguments that multiversality might have some value in a theoretical sense. I guess it might invoke the anthropic principle, which I kind of hate, but I mean the second anthropic principle that we were talking about. But yeah, it's great for science fiction stories, but holy smokes, I mean, if this is the strongest arguments that we've got for the existence of a multiverse, I find it really wanting.
I don't think there's any reason here to say that there should be a multiverse. I'm still not really that keen on the anthropic principle from the things I've been reading. Neither the multiversality, nor the why the universe is just so, nor the Tegmark and Wilczek paper, Dimensionless Constants, Cosmology, and Other Dark Matters, which has a great title, but it's long. And it's a lot more crap about axions. Actually, I think it does a lot better in some things, but it's much more technical. But I don't think they really explain why either of those things is really a great guide to the physics. Basically, all I get out of that is if we have a theory that is somehow incomplete, we can use the anthropic principle to sort of tell us what sort of sizes different things should be. And that still does not feel good. Now, we can look at the Weinberg paper. There's a reason why it's famous. We can look at that later on at some point and try to use that to see why people think the anthropic principle is so useful. I'm not sure if it's going to help us.
Well, you know, it is nice that it did kind of make a prediction on the dark energy density that was persuasive, but that's a different ball of wax than the multiverse idea, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm not sure if that's the really famous paper by Weinberg for that, because that's not really that amazing a prediction that the universe will have the maximum amount of dark energy that it can have and still have people in it. I mean, it's an interesting thing. So there might be actually another paper. I think there's got to be another paper, and I just don't remember what it's about, where Weinberg does something, really explains something with the anthropic principle.
And I also have to say that, you know, especially after seeing Sabine Hossenfelder's discussion about superstring theory. She did a video on YouTube about it and sort of the status of it and a little bit of the history of it and everything. It does seem like this multiverse idea was new with superstring theory, but I think superstring theory kind of suffered a lot of defeats every time it seems like it tried to predict something that they failed to see it. And now there's a question about whether it works within the positive cosmological constant universe that we have. And it seems like he's correct. Prematurely, you know. I think her first opening statement was, I'm going to talk about string theory because I'd like us to stop talking about string theory. Something like that, you know.
Is that all you got?
That's it. Thanks for your time, Jim. It's been a lot of fun talking about it.
Thanks for talking about this, Randy. It was really fun. Bye now. You have just listened to Physics Frontiers, episode number 55, Multiversality. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/55. The show notes include the papers we read for this podcast and other things I can think of. I think I mentioned a book. I think Randy mentioned a video and things like that. And now I'd like to thank all of the people who support us on Patreon. Let's just go down the list. I've got Linda Kilmer, Wasim Zahir, Paul Maritz, Alexander Milton, Jordan Lynn, Keva Naomi, Mark G, Peter Tremont, Ron McKinnon, Stephen Coleman, Tim Stefani, Tyler Durden, Sky D, B. Gordon Dana, Lucas Anner Walcher, Vicken Kilijan. Please email me if you're listening to this and tell me how to pronounce that. Chris Sherman, Dan Maxim, and Ian Helen. I've just read down the list from Patreon, so I'd like to thank you all very, very much for supporting us. And I'd like to thank everyone else for listening. Bye now.